I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 11th of August. Mondays at 1, we do all things political, and Jill Lawrence is our guest this hour, analyst, columnist, and commentary writer who's covered every presidential election since 1988. She's a national columnist for Creators Syndicate. She's been senior correspondent and managing editor for politics at the National Journal, political correspondent for USA Today, and national political writer at the Associated Press. She's also written about politics for The Week, Al Jazeera America, The Boston Globe, The Washington Post, and many other publications. We have a lot to talk about. We, of course, will start with Iraq and U.S. strikes on ISIS in Iraq. And evidently news today that we are also sending arms to the Kurds in Iraq. A spokesperson for the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said it's important to understand that our military objectives are limited in purpose. So what is the purpose? What is our future in Iraq? What in the world is Iraq's future? We will take that on the first part of our program. Jill has written a lot about immigration. Indications are the president will use his executive authority to keep many unauthorized immigrants from deportation. What is the latest on the large number of children at the border? And what about the immigration issue? How is it formulated by Republicans? Does it work to their disadvantage? She's written about that as well. A Washington Post ABC news poll has found that 51% of Americans disapprove of their own House member. That's the first time in 25 years that a majority disapproved of their own representative. And Congress now has a 12.6% approval rating. What does that mean for the midterms? A few of our many topics this hour. We'll be welcoming your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. I'm particularly interested, as we once again are in Iraq, what you see down the road for this country, what you see in terms of our involvement. Are you in favor of what we're doing right now? We'd like to hear your response to that. Jill, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yes, and thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah.
It's a very busy day.
It is.
Busy month in politics and foreign affairs.
Yeah.
I obviously, you know, our president was elected on a pledge to keep us, to get us out of Iraq and keep us out of Iraq, but he's been pushed into acting, and I think that he's using very careful language to leave his options open.
Mm.
He certainly left the time frame open. And, you know, it seems like every day we hear about some other thing that he's doing. You know, today it was arming the Kurds. Yesterday it was airstrikes. The day before it was humanitarian aid. So we're kind of moving inexorably towards more engagement. And I don't think that's a bad thing, as long as we have no boots on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably the response that we have now is the response that would have been best in Afghanistan after 9/11 and, best in Iraq, where we had a containment policy that was working. So I happen to trust the president's judgment. A lot of people don't. So, I mean, there are many opinions on this. There are people who think we should be much more aggressive and that we should be striking in Syria as well. In fact,
right.
Hillary Clinton kind of came out of the woodwork suddenly to sharpen her differences with the president. So, and of course, John McCain and Lindsey Graham and some members of the Senate, some conservatives on the Republican side, don't think Obama has been nearly aggressive enough. But he's really, you know, treading a fine line here, because Americans are not interested in getting embroiled in the Middle
right.
East again.
Yeah. What's hard for me to understand, Jill, is that this country has been so chaotic for so long. So many people died. Iraqis died. American soldiers died or were severely wounded. And you got to ask for what? Here we are at a point where al-Maliki has decided he does want to continue to be the prime minister. The new president appointed somebody else. So you've got that battlefront going on. You've got people in the country who seem to be incapable of uniting people. I mean, I just don't see an end game here for anybody.
Well, I think that's right, and I think it's clear that we've made things worse and that they have no intention of making things better. There was an interesting idea floated over the weekend by Ross Douthat in the New York Times, which is to just focus on the Kurds, focus on our allies, make Kurdistan the democracy that we thought maybe Iraq could be, and just, you know, consolidate our gains there. I think there's a lot of obligation that we feel because we went in and essentially the you broke it, you buy it type of feeling. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, how long do we pay? Mm-hmm. How many times do we pay? How many lives do we pay with? Already, this is going to, these two wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, are going to cost $4 trillion to $6 trillion.
Wow.
This is the most expensive couple of wars in history. This is on some Harvard research that's shown that, and that includes the cost of the wars, the cost of reconstruction, and the cost of caring for all of the veterans that they've created.
Yeah. What about ISIS? Does the administration get due criticism for not having seen this coming?
Well, Obama admitted that they didn't see it coming as fast as it was coming, but when they realized what was going on, they certainly have acted a lot faster than we're used to this administration acting. And I, you know, I think in some ways what's going on with them has vindicated his approach to Syria because, you know, when the Iraqi soldiers deserted their posts and let ISIS come in, they got a weapons windfall. And so now we're bombing our own equipment. I read somewhere that this is enough equipment to arm 200,000 soldiers.
Goodness.
Our equipment, our Humvees, our weapons. So, I mean, you know, the waste and the absurdity and the surreal ironies of all of this just go on and on.
Do you?
I guess you just have to pull the plug at some point, right?
Yeah. I don't know. I wonder if the American people, I haven't seen any latest polls on this, but it seems as though a lot of people want that to happen right now.
Well, they were pretty happy. People were pretty happy when Obama withdrew all the troops. You know, conservatives were not happy. Hawks like Hillary Clinton were not happy. You know, it seemed that Obama wasn't trying all that hard to keep people there. I know he's defended himself, saying that it was impossible politically for the Iraqis to pass any kind of protection for soldiers so that if they were defending themselves, they wouldn't get dragged into court there. But, you know, that's been the whole tenor of the country after 10, 14 years of war, just to get everybody home. And I think that they'd be happy with airstrikes. We'll have to see. There haven't been any polls since the airstrikes started, so we will see. Before they started, people were against it. They didn't want any involvement at all.
Right. Well, and you did look at this, and it was framed in terms of this horrendous humanitarian crisis with tens of thousands of people up on this mountain with no food, and they are a religious minority who've been persecuted, and evidently many of them were able to leave the mountain, and the Kurds have been able to hold back ISIS some. But you look at that situation and you say, and I guess the French and the British have done some airlifting too, that something had to be done to avert a humanitarian crisis. But it's just one other layer to this incredibly complicated and really sad situation.
Right. Well, that was, you know, he kind of gave two rationales. That was one of them, and the other was to protect our people. But the way he described the mission was a little bit broader than that, I thought, if you read between the lines. You know, he talked about the long time frame, and he talked about, you know, he had some conversation with the French president in which they agreed to talk about countering the long-term threat of ISIS. So, you know, there are some hints that this is going to be a preoccupation for some time.
Mm-hmm. And what do you make of al-Maliki and the new president or the new president naming another prime minister, al-Maliki saying, wait a second, I don't cut me out of this. I still want to be the prime minister. He's been a dismal failure. We're trying to withdraw our support for him. I mean, what's the outcome of that? What kind of leadership is there? Oh, man.
I know this is going to sound really strange, but my first thought when I heard about that was, wow, thank God for George Washington, we were so lucky. I mean, what if he hadn't felt like stepping down, you know?
Right.
I mean, these are really important moments for countries that are just forming and developing, and he's doing everything he can to sabotage their progress towards some kind of, you know, some kind of reliable partnership, some kind of stability and accommodation. And I mean, I don't know what we're going to do. you know, John Kerry usually runs to the scene of the crisis and tries to talk sense into people. I gather he's in Australia. I don't know if he's still there. But, I you know, what can we do? You just want to wash your hands of the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, that's a question for our – let's ask the audience. What should we do? Are you in favor of these bombings that have been taking place, targeting these ISIS forces? What do we do in that country after we fought there and so many people have died? And what should be our plan? We welcome your phone calls. We'll spend a lot of time on this issue. We're just going to move to several others with Jill and start taking a lot of calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We, of course, will return to this subject, but let's go on to immigration. You've written some interesting pieces on immigration, and let's start with the political ramifications of the Republicans' decision to many of them want to return immigrants and children back to their countries pretty much immediately. You framed it in terms of how the Republicans, the message from 2012 election, needed to reach out to Latino voters and to African-American voters. So what they've done may not get them more votes in the midterm and the elections?
Well, actually, there are some analysts who think, and I tend to agree, it might get them more votes, but it's not going to win them more races. It'll get them more votes in districts where they, you know, are going to turn out people who are very, you know, enthusiastic about all of this. And those would be districts that they would have won anyway. In the Senate races, it actually could have an impact in very close races. There are a number of toss-ups, for instance, Iowa, Colorado, North Carolina. So, you know, the question is, are the conservatives going to be more energized, or are these young Hispanics and Asians who are most at risk for, you know, if Republicans come into office and take control, they may be an activist force as well. So they could cancel each other out. We'll just have to see. I think the real consequences will be felt in 2016 because you even see these Republican presidential candidates and the National Party trying to make outreach moves towards Hispanics, even as the House and to some extent the Senate are, well, not the Senate really, but the House in particular are just, is just really being harsh. I mean, they want to end President Obama's program to let Dreamers stay in the country, the people who were brought here as kids before 2007. You know, this has changed their lives. This has revolutionized their lives. They can pursue futures they didn't have before, and nobody has more at stake than they do. So that, how can that possibly help Republicans? I just don't see it.
And tell me more about what the president indications are will use executive authority to deal with that very issue. Does he have wide-ranging options here when it comes to exercising authority on immigration?
Well, the way it's usually framed is that Congress has given him a certain amount of money which will allow a certain amount of deportations because they're expensive. And so he can deport the number of people the money will cover just by sticking to people who are troublesome or, you know, on, you know, people that are less desirable or have looser ties to America. And he can make a decision to not focus on people who have been here for a long time, who have jobs, who are closely related to legal immigrants here. And so he does have discretion. He can't deport everyone. He can't deport the 11 million. He doesn't have enough money. So the question is, how does he focus it? Now, it sounds like he's thinking about making it kind of an official policy, issuing an order or some kind of executive action in which he'll say, let's not pick on these people. You know, if these people have close ties, long ties, they have jobs, they're productive, they have long-standing residence here, well then, you know, that makes the president a target, but I'm not sure if it'll stick because he really does have discretion.
Mm-hmm. He's already deported hundreds of thousands of people, hasn't he?
Yes, and ticked off a lot of Hispanics,
right,
too. I mean, this is another one of these no-win situations. I think the reasoning by the White House was that if he was very strict about deportations and had a tough record and spent more on the border security and more on deportations, then it would be easier to get immigration reform passed, and that has not proven to be the case.
And finally for you, before we start going to phone calls, I was interested in an E.J. Dionne column over the weekend in which he cited a Washington Post ABC News poll, 51% of Americans disapproving of their own House member. We usually don't like Congress, but we like the person who represents us. The institution itself at a 12.6% approval rating. And yet we're hearing that the Republicans probably have a very good chance of getting the Senate right now. It seems to me that those dismal numbers would portend, I don't know, something, some real change.
Well, you would think, but people tend to, you know, the 51% doesn't mean that those 51% of people are going to vote. And a lot of times Republicans are more energized in midterms and conservatives more energized. And so you'll see, you know, that, for instance, in a generic poll of would you vote for the Democrat or the Republican, Democrats will have an edge. But then you'll go into the likely voter category, and Republicans will have an edge. And so even though people are unhappy, the majority of people may be unhappy with what's going on, you know, that doesn't translate into wholesale change in terms of Democrats taking over the House or even holding the Senate.
Jill Lawrence, our guest. It's All Things Political this hour. She's an analyst, columnist, and commentary writer who's covered politics for quite some time, national columnist for Creators Syndicate, and she writes for a number of publications and has been our guest several times for All Things Political. The big question, of course, of the hour is what you think of the airstrikes in Iraq. What do you make of al-Maliki deciding that he still would like to be president, but we don't want him to be president? What do you make of where that country is right now after we were at war for so many years? What's the future of the country, and what should our mission be there? Do you favor the strikes that have taken place? Are you upset about them? Feel free to call with your opinion, and we sure would like to hear from you. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Jill Lawrence, All Things Political, for this August 11, and we start with Carl in Madison. Hello, Carl.
Yes, hello. If you ask me what we should do now as far as bomb or not bomb, I think it's sort of like if you look at the Bush administration going backward and basically smacking a hornet's nest in a closed room, what do we do now? I think the answer is prepare to get stung. There was nothing that going into Iraq, guns a-blazing, was going to do for us, and on such false pretext, guarantee that there would be a tremendous pushback. Now that we're seeing that tremendous pushback, we are in a position where if we don't bomb, then ISIS takes over, and if we do bomb, then the only thing that guarantees is that there will be a prolonged conflict, and likely ISIS will take over then. And I would consider this just inept, but I think the people who make the weapons, I hate to sound so cynical, but I think the people who make the weapons really don't care the outcome as much as they care that weapons continue to be used so they can continue to be made. And so to hang this on Barack Obama, I certainly would say, all things being equal, let's side with the idea of not ticking off people in a part of the country that want nothing to do with us. And yet that seems to be what we do perpetually.
Mm. Do you think part of it, Carl, is that we just can't live with the idea that after all the loss of life, after all the money, after all the years in Iraq, this is what we've gotten, and we just can't bear to have paid that price for ISIS to take over?
Well, I live in Madison, Wisconsin, and we were marching down State Street with our signs prior to the run-up to the war in Iraq saying, do not invade. We all know where this is going, not because we're so brilliant, but because it's common sense. And so there was a time at one point to say, should we or shouldn't we? The challenge now is that it seems with every conflict, We go in. Many people say we shouldn't. We do anyway. Those people are proven right that we should not have gone in. But the other people say, well, let's wring our hands. What can we do now? We've so many soldiers' lives. And God bless and God help the people who have lost loved ones, children,
yes,
to this conflict. And God help the people who live in that environment that we continually stir up and drop bombs on and then step back and watch this retrenchment and regrowth of oppositional parties that have every reason to be ticked off at us for playing such ugly politics in their corner of the world. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult situation for everybody. But when I look back at who benefits from this, it keeps coming back to the people who make the arms and are in a position to say, hey, more money coming our way. And I'm afraid that's the only outcome I see. Certainly ISIS will not say, oh, you bombed us, now we'll all go home. It just provides that much more of an opportunity for recruiting because they say this is not a fair fight. This is not a civil war. We're fighting America. I don't want them to come over here. I don't want my children to die in this conflict. So I think the sooner we step away from it and stop ticking off so many people that have pretty good reason to be ticked off at us, I think the safer we'll be.
Jill.
Well, I think you can't eliminate the possibility that ISIS becomes like Al-Qaeda and starts planning attacks in Europe and America and all around the world. So that is a reason to be involved, certainly not on the scale that we were for 8 years in Iraq, but certainly to try to, you know, reduce their capabilities now in ways that we can do without sending soldiers in there to be caught in the crossfire. And I think that this is a wise course at this point. And if this is what we do and we do it temporarily and we're always on guard and come back and do it when the threat seems to be swelling, increasing and getting closer, that's one way of handling this. And it wouldn't be the first time that we walked away from a ground war without winning. We did it in Vietnam because we reached the point of diminishing returns. And I think that that's probably the point we're at in terms of a ground war anywhere in the Middle East.
You know, it seems, Jill, that we're having a very hard time getting information about how we're doing in an anti-terrorism effort. I can recall talk shows not that long ago when we had substantial people on the air saying, we've really been winning this. We've been targeting with drones these terrorist groups. Their numbers are just a handful of people. You know, maybe 1,000 people, 2,000 people, the war is almost won. And a year later, look what's happening. Do we even understand what's going on?
Well, you know, there's a lot of reporting about how conditions in Syria have morphed into a larger regional terrorist situation and that people are quitting Al-Qaeda and joining ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's now a regional problem. Now, some people think that if we kept our forces in Iraq that this wouldn't have happened. I'm really not so sure about that. Some people think if we had armed Syrian rebels that this wouldn't have happened. I'm not sure about that either because it's true what Carl was talking about. Things tend to get worse when we get involved. In fact, the New York Times has a front web page story right now about the leader of ISIS, and it says every step of his career was a reaction to or because of some move by the United States. So, you know, we create monsters, we create arsenals for
right.
these people, you know, that's counterproductive to say the least.
Yeah, well, we did support some Syrian rebels, didn't we? I don't know which ones we supported, but I remember that we were supporting some rebels.
Late in the game, Obama has said in recent days that it's hard to find people to arm, and that the force against the forces that we would be allied with are farmers and pharmacists and doctors, and not hardcore fighters. And he doesn't think that they ever would have stood a chance
mm-hmm.
against ISIS and the jihadists.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that may not have been a viable option. He may have been wise to keep us out of it for as long as he did.
Mm-hmm. Carl, thanks for your call. Larry in Kingston, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think President Obama has played this perfectly in Syria and Iraq. In Syria, he got the Russians to work with him to get rid of that sarin gas. If ISIL would have got their hands on that and did what they did in Iraq, now overthrowing the army and taking our equipment that we left behind, along with sarin gas, we would be in even deeper trouble. And the politicians that think we should put boots on the ground, they don't have any skin in the game. They don't have no kids in the army. You know, the middle class and the poor are who are in the army and in our armed forces. And, you know, the Republican Party, they don't want to do anything for the middle class or the poor. So, you know, what Obama's doing is, I think, is just playing it perfect.
Jill, what do you think?
Well, I that's a very good point about the sarin gas, and that didn't come about in the most clean way possible. You know, there was a whole lot of confusion when Obama said he was going to go to Congress and try to get permission for airstrikes, and it turned out that Putin, who at that time was being receptive to us and doing us a favor, he's the one who made the proposal to get rid of the chemical weapons, and that did work out well. In terms of boots on the ground, I mean, what we're talking about is a force of maybe 10,000 people that people like John McCain wanted to leave in Iraq as a you know, just a precautionary measure. And I will say he has at least one son, maybe two, who are in the military, so he knows what he's talking about. But, you know, there were many more people who didn't think that this would work, having a small force like that, given the historical divisions and struggles of that country.
Well, there are many who think that any force isn't going to work, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Thank you, Larry, very much for your call. Let's go to Chris in Madison. Hi, Chris.
Hey, guys. Hey, you know, here's the real question that needs to be asked. We sit here and we look at America and we talk about how America should be going in and bombing these places, and is it okay? A question I'd ask is, what happens if any one of these countries sent in an unmanned drone and, say, bombed part of Florida because maybe the leader of Crips or Bloods was creating chaos in their country? I don't think we have any authorization to be in another country, and we have a president who ran on campaigning of getting us out of war, but if I'm not mistaken, Obama has had us in more wars than the Republican Party has, so I honestly believe that the Republican and Democratic Party work hand-in-hand when it comes to waging war across the world. And Jill made a comment earlier in regards to Syria, but she misled the people because we were early on arming this group of rebels, which were actually considered death squads, which has actually branched off in this ISIL, which is also a branch of Al-Qaeda. And if you look into it, what's really interesting is here we are on the front lines yelling at the rest of the world, telling Putin, get your forces out of the Ukraine. Stop these Russian rebels, Russian separatists from invading Ukraine. But yet we did the same thing in Syria. We did the same thing in Libya. Now, you can tell me that it was because we had a terrible tyrant who was the dictator and running that country. We supported these countries for many years and put these dictators in power. These groups that we're sitting here fighting today, it makes no sense to the rest of the world when we say we got to go back in Iraq and bomb them because there's a couple thousand people stuck on a mountain. But yet in Gaza, an open-air prison where you see these people being murdered by the Jewish state and the help of the United States funding them and putting these war machines to act, and nobody blinks an eye on it. That's the real question. We shouldn't be in any of these countries. We have no authorization in it. We sit here and say we don't want Maliki as president. What about Iraq not wanting Obama as president? Why does it always have to be America has the right to say everything and everybody else has to follow?
Jill.
Well, one of the conditions that Obama talked about for going into Iraq with airstrikes is that the government of Iraq asked us to help. And so, you know, and also that there was a humanitarian crisis, not just a couple of thousand people, but 40, 50,000 people. So, you know, he had his reasons and he had authority, if you want to put it that way, from the host government. So, you know, people around the world want to rely on us when they want to rely on us. And then when we're inconvenient, they want us to leave. But I think that he's got a set of conditions and qualifications that there's a lot of hedges in them. And, you know, that's a high bar to clear before he will go in and do something, particularly if it involves more than, you know, a very short time frame of airstrikes. So I think a lot of people agree with that approach because they're tired of decades of war. But on the other hand, you know, there are people who don't think we should be there at all. I understand that point of view. And it's just trying to strike a balance between being the nation that everyone relies on and trying not to be the nation that's everywhere all the time and creating enemies in our wake.
Let's talk about the Middle East. Chris brought us into that for just a moment. The Egyptian brokered ceasefire halting the war has held into today, unless it's changed since we've been on the air.
Right.
Yeah, you just don't. And you think that that's probably the case by tonight. You know, it's another sort of intractable situation here. Where bad people have been elected, you know, Hamas, and Hamas has thrown rockets, and the Israelis, many think, have over-responded here. But here we go again, and here we go again, and here we go again, and then more hardliners become elected again. So, I don't know. Do you have any hopes for this truce?
Well, you know, I saw something that I hadn't seen before today, that there's a seaport that Gaza, the Palestinians want to build in Gaza. And it sounds like this could be kind of a focal point of the talks that are going on right now in the 72-hour ceasefire. And, you know, that seems like it could be something that, if it happened, might be a tangible, you know, evidence of goodwill. But, this is a situation, this is, again, a situation where, you know, they want us to help, but they don't want us to help. And what can we do? You know, it's kind of interesting that Egypt is in the middle of it and we're on the sidelines at this point, and we'll see what happens with that. Maybe that'll work better.
Mm-hmm. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. All Things Political is what you're listening to this hour with Jill Lawrence. A lot of our conversation, of course, centered on Iraq because of what's happened the last 3 days. But also we have the Middle East. We have midterm elections coming up. We have immigration. We have Ebola, which we have yet to talk about. Let's move into that for a moment. Lines are open for you. What do you think of what we're doing in Iraq right now? Place it in recent historical, or go not even recent, historical context. What are the possibilities of our helping to create a stable situation in Iraq, considering what's going on with the government, considering the chaos of the country? What do you think? What should we do? 800-486-8655 is the number, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jill Lawrence with us now, All Things Political. Just a few words on Ebola, because this is such horrible, horrible disease, and you keep hearing about the expansion, and it seems as though the world hasn't figured out how to take care of this. So understandably, there's some concern when you're treating, you know, American patients with this Ebola drug, and you're treating a Spanish missionary priest infected with the virus, but you got all these people in Africa who don't have access to this, and evidently no vaccine on the horizon.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. There's been a division among conservatives over the doctor who was doing missionary work and then was taken back to Emory for treatment after he contracted it, because you had Ann Coulter saying that he shouldn't have gone. What was wrong with helping people in America? And, you know, now look what's happened to him, and look what he's putting our country at risk and our doctors at risk. And Eric Erickson from Red State, another conservative, says he thinks she's wrong on this, and that people have a right to go and help where they think help is needed. But it's, you know, it speaks to the terror of the disease, that just the idea that one or two people are at an isolation unit in a university hospital that's completely designed to treat this sort of thing, mm-hmm, is creating this type of division.
Yeah. Let's go to Ralph next in Little Suamico. Hi, Ralph.
Yes, hello. I didn't think I'd get on this quick. I'm not prepared, Red. But I got my thoughts together now. It kind of coincides with your other callers, but it seems like what we do is we furnish military aid to certain parties, and then they blow up parts of another country or their own country, and then we furnish humanitarian aid, and we rebuild schools and hospitals and so forth that got blown up, and then 10 years later, they use military aid to blow up the same hospitals that we just rebuilt. And it's crazy. It should, the U.S. should be saying, humanitarian aid, that's all we do.
Jill.
I think that that's a great idea, a great thought, a very idealistic thought. But when there are national security interests at stake, I think the president understands he needs to go further than that. Because if we don't stop ISIS, you know, our embassy is at risk, our personnel throughout the country in Erbil and other places are at risk. And so, you know, we also have the risk of the same thing that happened before 9/11 with training camps and plans for attacks all over the world. So this is not something you want to see happening. And if it takes a military force, hopefully pinpointed short-term military force, then that's something a president really has to think about. So, you know, I understand where you're coming from. I really wish that would work. But, you know, a president gets up every morning and listens to the threat report from his intelligence advisors and hears things that would terrify us if we knew what they were. So they have a different perspective on these things. And, you know, after 9/11, I think that Bush was completely traumatized, and every president, well, Obama too, and every presidential candidate since, in terms of keeping it, people safe, not letting it happen again.
Thanks, Ralph. Julie in Eau Claire. Hi.
Hi. I'm just talking about the extreme Islamic group, ISIS, and the other groups. You know, I think, like the other caller had said, I think President Obama was playing it, you know, the way that it probably should have been played. But I would have thought he would have gone in a little bit earlier when they were leaving Syria, going into Iraq. I was listening to the BBC last night, and they had a couple of guests on from Iraq saying that, you know, the U.S. actually has an agreement, you know, with Iraq to you know, defend their government or try to hold their government up. So I'm not really sure about that. That's just what was on last night. And if that's true, then, you know, I guess we, if we have agreed to that, then we're obligated to do that. And, you know, their outlook is, at least is what they have told, you know, and reported the extreme Islamic belief. They don't want any of us around, any other religions or people. You know, you're either with them or not, and if you're not, they want to annihilate us. So what should we do? You can't let them grow into such a huge force that they're going to go into, you know, more than one, two, three countries, you know, and that's their mission, to take over.
Jill.
Well, that's true, and, you know, what they're trying to do is form a caliphate, which is just incredibly barbaric and brutal, and the treatment of women is beyond even discussion. It's so horrible. But, you know, Obama has said he's not going to let that happen. But he's doing a little balancing act here, because he is also saying we're not going to help unless you put together a stable government that we can rely on. We can't do this without a partner, because we can give all the help we want. We can do everything that we can think of to do. But if they don't have a government that works, then as soon as we leave,
right,
the whole thing's going to fall apart.
Right.
And I don't think he plans to stay there forever. I don't think he plans to bomb forever. And so he's trying to give them an incentive to make this work. And now we're at the point where al-Maliki is saying he's not going to do anything to make it work. He's not going to get out of the way. So this is a kind of a moment of truth. And don't know. I think, you know, they're going to try very hard to handle it diplomatically, but, you know, we'll see what they withhold if the government doesn't get its act together.
Yeah. Well, and how many years do you have to give it to the government that works? We were there fighting for 8 years, for heaven's sake. And so how many years does it take to have a government that is inclusive, a government that will work? And do we have to be in charge of that as well? Do we just sort of take over the whole place and say, you know, here's how you need to do it, and we'll have to help you along here for the foreseeable future, which might be years and years and years and years?
I mean, this is what Bush envisioned when he went in, but I don't think he understood that it wouldn't happen except at the point of a gun, probably.
Right.
So, you know, we do bear responsibility for messing up this whole country and creating untold suffering and the current situation. I don't think we can continue paying for it. I think we've probably paid enough.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for your call, Julie. We go to Dave in Marshfield next. Hi.
Hello. I've been kind of wondering where to start, and I think I'll go back quite a ways, 15 years or more, when I couldn't figure out why W had $400 million in a campaign fund before he even declared candidacy. When I watched the towers go down for about the eighth or tenth time, it finally dawned on me, government contracts. If we are going to do anything about any of the political strife around the world, we have to follow the money. It's like what we're trying to do is like controlling a river way downstream and keep making the dikes higher and responding to each little breakthrough instead of looking upstream at the origins.
I'm missing your
and
point.
I think the origins are some political strife between people, but what fuels it all, what is the huge rains, the huge snowfalls that feed this miserable river, is the corporations that, and individuals across the world that profit hugely from war.
All right. Now I get your point. Jill.
Well, it's true that corporations profit hugely from war. That said, I think President Bush would have done anything to not have 9/11 happen on his watch. And a lot of his money was coming from people who knew he wanted immigration reform and he wanted to be known as the education president. He was going to be good for business. Business wants immigration reform. Business needs a good education system. So, you know, he had money, yeah. And Republicans don't usually cut defense budgets. So, yeah, he probably has some defense money, too. But, you know, nobody wants a war.
Thank you very much for the call, Dave. We have lines open, and if you want to join our conversation, please do. The question of the hour is, what do you think of our latest bombing in Iraq? What do you think is a solution to making ISIS a less potent and dangerous and horrific force? What have we done wrong here? Are we doing the right thing now? What should we be doing, if anything? We'd really like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. I want to move to the midterms for just a moment, Jill, because by golly, they're right around the corner. It seems like everybody would be talking about this all the time, but we're not. So I don't think I've asked you, but do you think that the Republicans will take the Senate?
Well, all the calculators and aggregators say they have a better than even chance. Of course, there's still several months, and it's a question of some of these toss-ups, which way they go. It does seem that Republicans have the trend going their way, but if you look at the individual races, some of the candidates are interesting. For instance, in Kentucky, Allison Grimes versus Mitch McConnell, you know, or in North Carolina, the Republican there who's running against the incumbent Kay Hagan, he's having a lot of trouble because the legislature that he's an official in is kind of going way to the right to the point where there's a backlash. So, you know, a lot of these individual races are going to come down to turnout. I know we always say that, but a lot of times it's true.
Yes, it is, yeah.
Such even divisions in the country, and Democrats are trying to ramp up their turnout machine that works in presidential elections but has never yet worked in a midterm. They say it worked last year in Virginia when Terry McAuliffe won, the Democrat, but he didn't win by very much, and so it may have been the difference, but it didn't give him much of a cushion. Mm-hmm. And he was running against a candidate who really didn't match the demographics of the state. So, you know, the chances of this, it's an interesting proposition. If Democrats turned out the way they need to and the way they do in presidential elections, then Democrats would do a lot better. But there's no assurance that's going to happen. Mm-hmm. The Republicans really have the edge.
So is McConnell in trouble in Kentucky?
I think he is. I don't know how much. I mean, he managed to dispatch a Tea Party primary challenger very easily. Now, the latest thing that's been uncovered is that his wife is on the board of Bloomberg Philanthropies, which is pro-gun control and pro-global, I mean, pro-measures to fight climate change, which means anti-coal. So she's kind of associated in an indirect way with the war on coal. And I think that, as people say, this is a political ad. You don't even have to write. It writes itself. So these are the kinds of things that a race can turn on, and you just never know.
Yeah. Are you paying attention to the Wisconsin gubernatorial race? There are polls that show that it's fairly close. I don't know if you follow, if we put faith in polls or not. Do you think it's close?
I do.
Really?
It's a real interesting situation. Mary Burke is probably not the perfect Democratic candidate. You know, she is really rich, and she did outsource a lot of jobs, right? But, there's inherent polarization that Scott Walker hasn't really done much to assuage. I mean, in fact, he's inflamed it. So, and the jobs record is not terrific.
Mm.
There are ways to run against him. I'm not saying he's going to lose, but the stakes for Democrats are so high in Wisconsin because if he wins, he's a presidential candidate.
Right. Isn't that something that it comes down to? Your prospects come down to your reelection prospects.
Right, maybe 1,000 votes if it's close.
Wow. And you mentioned Bloomberg. Bloomberg's money is making its way into the Milwaukee County Sheriff's primary tomorrow because guns are an issue in that. So I'm wondering how much money he's going to be putting into various campaigns.
Well, I would say tens of millions, right?
Wow.
He spent nearly $10 million a few years ago in his first dry run of all of this. And he's serious. He's serious about these two issues, mostly gun control. Now, there is a backlash effect sometimes when he gets involved, when his money gets involved in a race. People don't like the fact that a New Yorker, a former mayor, is trying to dictate the course of their elections. Of course, that happens with all outside money, but he's such a well-known person
right. And
so controversial. So, that could have a boomerang effect.
Yeah. Let's go to one more phone call. Joyce in Wausau. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I'm wondering why more hasn't been done with the other countries over there, like the Saudi, the Arab Emirates and the Saudis and Dubai and those places, because they certainly should have an interest whether they're Sunni or Shia, because their countries are not as extreme as ISIS. So are they trying to work with any of those countries? I know some of them, like Jordan and places like that, have taken in refugees and things, but mm-hmm. actually fighting against ISIS.
Jill, about 30 seconds.
I'm really glad you asked that because I was thinking about that myself. And I think I haven't read too much about that, but I don't think that Obama talks a lot about what he's doing. I would not be surprised to find that that's either happening or will happen, because that's obviously, they have the most interest, the most at stake, and should be taking the lead.
Mm-hmm. Jill, thank you. I love having you as a guest because you give you a subject and you know the subject. It doesn't matter what it is. Yeah, it's great.
I enjoy being on.
Thanks, Jill. We'll call you again. Thank you so much. Jill Lawrence, our guest for All Things Political. Jill is an opinion writer for Creators Syndicate, and she has done, all kinds of work with a number of different publications. She writes not only for... she's written for the Washington Post. She's written for the Washington Post and the New York Times and Associated Press. She was with them for a number of years. And we thank her so much for being with us to talk about all things political. And she knows her politics. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from NPR, and we'll return with another hour for this Monday.